Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Iran, Iraq, and Libya. He is a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and was the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups and a senior regional analyst. He also served as the State Department's intelligence analyst on Libya. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne White.
My pleasure.
And Wayne, you have a piece at loblog.com, Libya's Deepening Post-War Agonies. And I must say it's a pretty depressing account of a country that you are warning is drifting into what could be considered a failed state scenario.
Exactly.
So elaborate, if you will, on how close we are to that, because obviously most of the coverage we get because of this Republican obsession with this sort of phony Benghazi story, which 60 Minutes managed to embarrass itself over, but very little attention is being paid on the real situation in Libya.
Yeah, that's been a huge distraction with respect to Libya, which requires a lot more of a look across the board. Effectively, the central government has lost control over most anything that matters in the country, the Prime Minister Ali Zeidan. And it's sad because if you go back, scroll back 2 years, there was an election for the legislature in Libya where it was feared the Islamists would gain the upper hand, as they have in Tunisia and they have in Egypt, flanking Libya. And the result was different. The population rejected the Islamists, and by a not overwhelming majority, but a significant majority. And it looked like things were going to develop very positively, and not like it had been in Egypt and Tunisia. But instead, the militias have not disarmed. And I think part of the reason, a large reason, for the lack of disarming is their disappointment and even anger over the results of the election. But there are deeper issues. There are huge regional issues in this country, huge tribal differences in this country, which Gaddafi shamelessly exploited for 40 years to keep himself as sort of the first among equals by playing tribe against tribe and handing out favors to regions and whatnot. And so Libya, which never really was a coherent state, when it was founded, finally given independence after World War II and spent time under King Idris in a very low-level government in which he sort of allowed a lot of autonomy and development was minimal, has left this country really without a sense of nationhood.
So, but this is obviously affecting the neighbors. If, as your article at Loblog, Wayne White, Libya's Deepening Post-War Agonies, points out that in the east, the militiamen from the Al-Zawiya tribe have seized up to 200 Egyptian drivers, demanding the release of some of their associates who are being held by the Egyptians for weapon smuggling. That would indicate to me that we already have a pretty unstable situation in Egypt. The last thing they need in Egypt is a bunch of weapons being smuggled in.
Exactly, and it's clearly happening because the Egyptians apparently caught these people pretty red-handedly. And one thing that allows it to happen is without a central government that really can effectively control its borders, this vast desert open to the east between the east of Libya, west of Egypt, can be used by weapon smugglers, many who can travel with camel caravans, others who can actually make the trip with pickup trucks and four-wheel drives.
So this is a country where the prime minister, as you mentioned, he was briefly kidnapped on October the 10th by his own bodyguards, wasn't it? Or at least his...
Yes.
Yeah.
The government has had such lack of success in fielding anything that resembles a national army or a reliable police force, either locally or nationally, in the latter case, that it has tried to tame militias by putting them on the government payroll, certain ones that are not the radicals, in order to function in the role of national army and police forces for localities and for Tripoli, the capital. And it's not worked. It's clear, as I note in the article, that first and foremost, they take their orders from the chiefs of them are militias and not the government, even though they're taking government pay.
So it sounds like, though, you've got a kind of Mad Max situation with these various militias. There was a big battle on November the 7th between militias from Tripoli and Misrata. So is that a correct analogy? Is it a bit like Mad Max with all these guys driving around in pickup trucks with big guns mounted on them?
It's getting there. That's the standard thing they have, much like technicals in Somalia who had these pickup trucks mounting light anti-aircraft guns. That's what a lot of the militias use for their heavy heavy firepower. Unfortunately, Zaidan, the prime minister, called upon the people to, you know, who also voted against Islamists and this kind of militia violence, to sort of express popularly their anger and protest against this, and they actually did it. You know, in after I wrote that article, in Tripoli, they protested outside a militia fortress in the city, only to have the militia open up on them from the roofs of its fortress with anti-aircraft guns, killing over 100 people, wounding 300 or 400. Starting a battle, because then people ran away and came back at night with their own weapons and started blasting away at the militia. And so it's obviously not going to be solved by any popular pressure on these people.
Well, it's also not going to be solved by any outside pressure. I mean, it was, after all, the NATO intervention that brought about the downfall of Gaddafi. But it seems like we sort of declared victory prematurely there, don't you think?
We absolutely. The other problem was that not enough was put into the country in the way of foreign assistance, which was intended, because the country just wouldn't settle down, and you couldn't consider as many people as you would have wanted to do that safe. I'm talking about even reconstructing infrastructure, not just the security forces, the army, and whatnot, and that's held off the Brits and us and others from trying to go in there and try to fix things. And then you have the Benghazi factor. It extends far beyond the United States, because other governments have seen the bashing that the Obama administration has taken because of Benghazi. There has doubtless been some people thinking about this and saying, well, we don't need one, you know, in Libya, and so let's keep our people out and evacuate our embassies or keep them at short staff. There have been 3 embassy attacks just in the last 5 or 6 months. Didn't result in anything really serious except the evacuation of those embassies. But I think Benghazi, not only paralyzing the U.S. from attempting anything to help in Libya, also has been noticed by people like the French, the Brits, the Italians, and others with interest there.
Well, obviously, there's a lot of European countries that depend upon, or at least get a lot of oil and gas, particularly the Italians, from Libya. But
absolutely,
it seems to me, from what I've got from your article at loblog.com, Wayne White, Libya's Deepening Post-War Agonies, is that you are heading towards a state collapse. Not that the state's, in fact, you really have a state to begin with, but a truly and manifestly failed state like Somalia. If this government doesn't get any revenues, and it's completely dependent upon its oil sector, and the oil sector, which normally would produce 2 million barrels a day, is down to only a few hundred thousand, various groups are now claiming the oil infrastructure, are occupying it. You've got a group called the Government of Barker which is a shadowy government. It's established itself as a companion oil company in Tobruk, where it is basically taking over from the Libya's official National Oil Corporation. So walk us through this crisis, or this growing crisis, because as long as the oil is not getting to market, then the revenues don't come in for this government, and it sounds like the Western oil companies are starting to pull out or even think about selling their stakes in Libya.
Definitely. Everything you said, wish it wasn't true, but yes, the government is running out of revenues. It has no control now, practically, over the major oil fields, even those in the West, where the major terminal has been taken over by a militia that is blocking liftings on the part of foreign tankers, and has blocked the underwater gas pipeline to Italy. And so you have a government that's going to fast run out of revenues. The only leverage it had left in withholding or giving payment to certain client militias, even though they weren't working out very well, and that is now dribbling away, and the government is going to default within a month or two. And it's ironic that before things got so bad and his own authority became so obviously nil, Ali Zaidan threatened to cut off militias that would not cooperate with the government from any of their payments at the end of this year. Well, he's not going to have any money to pay him anyway, and so it's sort of going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So you've got the Berbers in the West seizing this big oil terminal and cutting off the pipeline that takes natural gas to Italy under the Mediterranean. And then in the East, you've got this so-called government of Barca. And what are they controlling? What's at this terminal in Tobruk? Is that a big oil terminal?
No, they set up their government out there, but only temporarily. They're going to move it to Benghazi, the main capital of the East. And it's still, even that capital is about 200 miles from the terminals. But there's no way the government can get those terminals back. And that eastern region used to be a distinctive region of the country with some autonomy under King Idris, when the country was divided up into several regions that had this sort of lax autonomy. But Idris didn't have to worry about it because he came from the east. That was his power base. And so he gave it autonomy, knowing that they had to answer to him. But in this case, the man in Tripoli and the National Assembly does not answer. The people in the East do not answer to them. And so this is more of a threat than it ever could have been under King Idris, who Gaddafi overthrew in 69.
So, Wayne White, what is going on with the foreign oil holdings? Like ExxonMobil, apparently they're reducing their activity in Libya. Marathon Oil is thinking of selling up its joint venture with the Libyans. And BP have also decided, or in talks, to relinquish their stake in these various projects with Libya's National Oil Corporation.
Well, this is going to be severely damaging because that means that when you downstream, you're not going to have Libyan oil exports increase, even if they could be put back under control of the National Oil Corporation and properly administered. So Libya's oil exports are going to be capped. The lack of foreign expertise in the fields, because most foreigners have fled, the governments have ordered them out, the fields are going to deteriorate, and so Libya's export potential downstream will actually slowly erode downward in a country which, if you remember the savagery of the war between Gaddafi and the rebels that eventually took him down, backed by the West and the UN to some degree, the country was devastated. many areas of the country were smashed up quite badly, and there's a crying need not only to repair that damage, but also to get the country up to speed in terms of a lot of infrastructure that Gaddafi sloppily administered and allowed to decay and fall into disrepair.
But you were saying earlier that essentially the majority of the country wants a secular government, and I don't know the extent to which these so-called militias are really Islamists. I mean, obviously, there's always a thin line here between religious dogma and criminal activity.
They're hard to sort out because some appear to be purely local, but even in that case, let's take the third largest city, Misrata, which is not far from Tripoli, but just down the coast a little bit. And Misrata is not just ruled by really one militia. It's really ruled by a coalition of several, and a couple of them are Islamist militias. And this is what you have in many areas. In the east, you don't have sort of one militia in charge of everything. You have a lot of local militias, and they are a mosaic of political views, but most of them are to some degree at least moderately Islamist. Then in the south, there are mountain towns under control of their Berber militias. They tend to be a little more secular, but that isn't helping the government one bit because it can't control that area. And meanwhile, Al-Qaeda types, not affiliated with these militias in most cases, operating separately throughout the Maghreb and the Sahara, are just transiting Libya at will and using it as a refuge.
Well, just in closing, Wayne White, you mentioned that Benghazi has made this whole the possibility of any Western intervention or support for this frail government that's running out of revenues within the next 2 months is because of this hyped-up Benghazi situation. The 60 Minutes piece, of course, their apology didn't seem to affect Senator Lindsey Graham, who quoted the 60 Minutes piece on the Senate floor, and yet has not retracted his, jihad, if you will, against Hillary Clinton and the White House. And is there any sense in Washington that this kind of petty partisanship is really destructive for U.S. foreign policy?
Oh, it is. It is. And it's also destructive for our policy overseas. And I don't want to sound callous here, but in the eyes of terrorists, in the eyes of regimes that oppose us most bitterly and dangerously, the fact that the United States puts itself into a massive political spin, sort of a maelstrom of self-recrimination over the deaths of a few people in one relatively small incident. And I'm not trying to be callous. That's what it looks like on the world scene compared to casualties in many other areas. Just look at how many people we lose in Afghanistan in a month. Anyway, that just shows them that the United States has no tolerance for any losses, and therefore if you can threaten to inflict such losses on the United States, even potentially or possibly, you can keep the United States at bay. You can essentially neutralize U.S. power. This has been a problem all along, that we don't tolerate casualties, and I don't think we would want to. But in any case, we've been far more sensitive to them than, for example, than the French, who have intervened in Mali and swept an Al-Qaeda affiliate out of Mali, losing, it lost some of its troops in that operation. And so in some situations like Afghanistan and Iraq, they see the United States piling in and losing vast numbers of people by comparison. And then they see these other incidents now where the United States, weary of all that, seems to be pulling back, drastically and is in no position to project power in a way that could threaten them.
Well, Wayne White, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Iran, Iraq, and Libya. He's a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and was the State Department's representative to the NATO Middle East Working Groups and a senior regional analyst. He also served as the State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. He has an article at loblog.com, Libya's Deepening Post-War Agonies. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how progressive groups are pushing for Elizabeth Warren to challenge Hillary Clinton for the presidency in 2016.